Where were last week? Right, so we set up that there's a Gemara that sets up a machloket about whether a man is obligated or permitted to redeem his wife at more than what we're calling market value. Possible that he is obligated to redeem her the first time and then permitted the rest of the time, obligated the first time, forbidden the rest of the time, permitted the right. The machloket about whether he's obligated. Right, one position, Rebbe says he has to obligate the redeemer the first time at whatever value, and then there's a debate whether the other right, which positions argue, whether the positions argue or not about the any subsequent times. We talked about how that relates to an obligation written into the ketubah and how that all ties in. Right, Rebbe says that he's obligated the first time. Rosh Hashanah Gamliel just says we don't redeem captives more than their value. But we don't know which statement, which part of Rebbe's statement he's talking about. Is he talking about the permission to do it the second and third time, the obligation to do it the first time, whatever. Okay, right, that's, and then we pointed out that Rosh Hashanah Gamliel's position is also stated anonymously without any context in a Mishnah and Gittin. Just says, and that's the line everybody knows, we don't redeem captives for more than their value. The question is this just Rosh Hashanah Gamliel's statement? Either Rosh Hashanah Gamliel holds this even in the case of husbands and wives, or they're separable, right? This position is consensus. That position is controversy. We talked about all the commentaries, right, fundamentally debating about whether there's something unique about wives that would allow you, even if there's a general lack of obligation or prohibition against redeeming captives above value, maybe that doesn't apply to wives. And if it doesn't apply to wives, why doesn't it apply to wives? Maybe because husbands are emotionally connected to wives in a really deep way. And in that case, maybe it extends past wives, or maybe it doesn't, right? Depends how literally we take Yishto Kegufo, his wife is like him. Maybe it's because there's a special obligation that the rabbis wrote into the ketubah, which they intended to override any subsequent prohibition against redeeming captives above their value, right? Because we believe in the marital relationship, because I'll believe in the marital relationship when they built it into the ketubah. Or alternatively, we will say like that we don't restrain anybody from redeeming themselves. People are allowed to spend their money to save themselves. And since the wife's obligation is encoded in the ketubah, so she's really just spending her own money. Right? She's just enacting her lien against her husband. Right? So she's not...
If you said it that way, wouldn't it be capped by the ketubah?
So then the question is, right? That's where, right, that way the second machloket about whether it's capped by the ketubah or not, right? Where Rosh Hashanah Gamliel says there's never an obligation to redeem it more than the ketubah. But maybe Rebbe says no, right? The rabbis put in a one-time, uncapped obligation to redeem your wife, because it's unlikely, right? So if my rabbi is like it's like a very expensive life insurance policy in addition to it, right? Right. And so then we did the Gemara, which said that seemed like in the end the rabbis did this, but they formally set it up as a counter for the husband's right. To the usufruct, right, of the property that the wife brings into the marriage. That's how they formally set it up, because they like to set up economic relationships in marriage as quid pro quos and not simply as rights of one party. So the Gemara says that maybe that's why didn't they do it in terms of mizonot, and it has an explanation, right? The likely and the unlikely, right? We'll talk about those things. At the end of the day, it's right, just built into marriage that the husband gets this, the wife gets that. And this is, unlike most things in marriage, this seems like not to be negotiable around, right? That we don't give the wife the option of saying, well, I get to keep all the product of my own land. You don't have to redeem me. So we build it an absolute obligation, husbands to redeem their wives regardless. Okay.
Rabbi
but
Klapper?
Yes.
But it doesn't go the other way. The Gemara doesn't bring up.
Wives having an obligation to redeem husbands.
Right.
That's correct. Because
so it must be related to the ketubah.
Yeah, I think that's right. If it's an obligation, then it's related to the ketubah. If it's a permission, then it could just be like just like we permit you to redeem yourself. Right. So we permit you to redeem your wife, even though you have no obligation to redeem her above market value.
Right, but if it's not related to the ketubah, then you would think she would have an equal obligation to redeem her husband.
I guess you could, you know, if in a, you know, in a world which has egalitarian economic assumptions.
Oh, well, let's say he's kidnapped,
right?
Her father dies without any other children, so she inherits her father.
Yeah, so there are ways in which she could have money, but to create an obligation would often just bankrupt her, right, with no possibility of further income. So we tend not to create those sorts of financial obligations on women, I think, in a non-egalitarian society. In a society without egalitarian economic assumptions, we right, think that imposing economic obligations of women...
We wouldn't make it an obligation, though...
We might give her a right to.
The situation is...
Right. If she had the money, we might very well allow her to.
Right.
In the same way that we allow husbands to. But the obligation is unlikely to go the other way. We could have just said reciprocal obligations. Husbands have obligations to redeem wives. Wives have obligations to redeem children. But we don't... Husbands, we don't... We generally assume that wives just don't have the economic means to do that. And asking wives to spend their own money is setting them up for bankruptcy.
Right.
Poverty. Right. Not fair. Okay, right. So we ended up by starting going through the how the Rishonim read the sugya. We ended with right with a really interesting language on page 5 in Rabbi Yonasan Akonim Luniel, right, who says lefichach ein milamdin lehem liftot shvuyin miadam yoter michtei damo. We don't teach people, and that seemed like a very interesting position, which seemed to acknowledge that maybe we can't stop people, and maybe we don't want to tell people that it's forbidden, right? Because that sets halacha up as a direct opposition to people's best instincts. But we just don't teach that you have to. Right? You know, like we're if people want to go overboard, we can go overboard. But we're not, right? But that seemed like a real way that we're never going to say is forbidden. And if we're never going to say it's forbidden, so then all the, you know, a lot of the subsequent conversations, this is not so relevant on a public policy level. But one of the things that I think isn't done well enough here is figuring out, say that we might say that there's never a prohibition against individuals using their money for that purpose, but that there is an obligation for the custodians of public funds to use their funds well. If it's not an obligation, then you can't use public funds for it. Right. So we might make that distinction as well. And this goes back. We point out that the original context of the greatest mitzvah of Pidyon Shvuyim is talking specifically about the context of the use of public charitable funds, right? So maybe that's right. We ended that distinction. Like, we don't teach people that they have to do it, and we don't. And as a community, right, you can't spend public funds to redeem specific captives in excess. The Gemara in Gittin said that this position is based on Tikkun Olam. The Gemara there said there are two explanations of Tikkun Olam. One is we're afraid that they'll capture people more, and the other we're afraid that you'll impoverish the community. Those reasons can intersect because we can claim, why are we worried about them capturing more people? Not because we're worried about the capturers, but we're worried we'll have to spend more money, and eventually we'll go bankrupt. Right. So we talked about the standard halachic position is that the way we frame it is that we're worried about them coming back and capturing more, and not so much about poverty. But we'll see. Not everybody, even though that's the standard framing, we'll see that people keep bringing in the other rationale as well, because they're connected. Because they're connected. In the end, like, you know, we wouldn't worry so much about captivity if we could always redeem people rapidly.
Isn't the fichach, we don't teach to do it?
Yeah.
Was that in the context of husbands and wives, or just more generally?
It's generally, we're worried that people, right, says they're afraid that captors will raise the prices. So we tell you don't overpay. Right. Again, though, we haven't yet addressed the question of how you establish the market price, especially in the absence of a slave market. And is the price for Jewish slaves or non-Jewish slaves, right? All those, right? And what constitutes poverty? Particularly if you're a wealthy society, right? I argued that probably it meant the shift in standard of living, as opposed to actual poverty, but lav dafka. Okay,
obviously I'm coming into this late. How much is the discussion an economic one? Like, a lot of what you've just described has a strong economic component. Mm-hmm. And some of these arguments about not going bankrupt could just as well apply to markets that don't have to do with human beings, right? You could say, hey, listen, don't start paying a lot of money for apples, because all of a sudden they'll make
right. But I think we generally assume that we're not worried. I'm sure if we had realized that there's a risk that people will pay, will pay crazy prices for tulips, mm-hmm. I would say don't engage in speculative, uh-huh. Right? Don't spend public money on speculative bubbles, and don't spend private mm-hmm. money that way either. Generally, right, the way that as I understand it, the way the Talmud regulates is by saying it has a certain amount of faith in markets,
mm-hmm.
with an appreciation that markets are often distorted by all sorts of features. And so there are prohibitions mm-hmm. against breaking a reasonable market.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the... that's the right. That's, you know, and public funds shouldn't be expended over market. Whenever public funds are spent above market price, you're suspicious. But here, right, there's a counter argument. People might think you have to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we counter by saying, no, you don't have to do it. And whether we go so far as prohibited, that's the right. That's the really big question.
What do we know about what it was, what the hostage business was like back then?
That's a really interesting question historically about which I don't, like, I'm not a historian. We'll do, at least in the beginning, we'll talk about the internal perception, right? Like many poskim will make claims about the historical context of particular halakhot.
Mm-hmm.
Right, you know, I can't tell you that I know. You know, there are certain famous cases. We may get to that one this week. There's a case of the Rabbi Meir of Rothenburg who refuses to allow himself to be redeemed.
Mm-hmm.
Right, that becomes a light post for many later people, but yeah, I don't. I talked about last week how Agus has a theory that the Jews were really good at avoiding being taken hostage prior to the First Crusade, and the First Crusade is what turns an incredibly powerful and wealthy community into a needy community,
mm-hmm.
and that changes everything. So there's it, right. So in the early Middle Ages, right, Agus thinks that, you know, that Jews are in a really good position, but the Talmud is really talking about, you know, is a dialogue across many, many centuries, which is mostly flattened in multiple different economic universes. Mm-hmm. And even we talk about it now, right? So, like, there isn't a world Jewish community in many, like, in some ways there were, like, you know, when it came to the Soviet Union, we had a world Jewish community that, you know, that invested itself in certain ways. But the situation of, you know, Jews in poorer countries is different than the situation of Jews in richer countries. And that was true in the time of the Talmud also. Yes, mm-hmm. I'm nervous about making historical generalizations, so I'm mostly going to function on the internal or the mythos of the system. Mm-hmm. This is what the system says about itself. And then at some point, you know, we can talk about, like, we know about the situation of current Israeli poskim and how they perceive themselves is going to be very interesting. Right? Mm-hmm. How Rav Avadia situates himself. And we're going to get through Rav Avadia today, and remembering that Rav Avadia is this, right, that when the question is brought up about Entebbe, the official policy of the State of Israel has always been, we don't negotiate with terrorists. Right, so we know that historical situation, and then we'll see how many people talking about this in Torah nowadays, you know, are working on the assumption that Gilad Shalit was the trade for Gilad Shalit was a terrible decision.
Mm-hmm.
But no one knew that in advance, and so you'll find, you know, right. So we'll find Rav Avadia talking, or somebody claiming they spoke to Rav Avadia about the Gilad Shalit trade and approving it. So it's hard to say that's an internal halachic conclusion. You shouldn't make dumb decisions, right? I guess we all agree, right? You shouldn't make dumb decisions, but it's possible within halacha to make dumb decisions.
But these are tough decisions. Anything to do with captives is not smart or dumb. It's just tough.
Yeah. So all we're trying to do is figure out, like, you know, is how you weight things, right? They're always going to be, and I try and always to teach when I do halacha, like, there's always a gap between the law and the current situation, because the law never applied to this situation because something has always changed. But the law biases you. And right, how it biases you is an important question. So does the law bias you towards, you know, if we can pay it, we will, right? You have to prove to me that this is really, really dumb. But the strong default is that we pay whatever price is reasonable. Yeah, we can't pay any price because then there's no negotiation. Right. So I think that's an unreasonable position that you pay any price. Right. You know, it's a political statement, right? But pay any price. But everyone, you know, like, even the people standing up and waving, and having public rallies, right, bring the hostages home, no matter what, understand that if the price of right, of bringing the hostages home is Israel has to remove all warning posts on the Gaza border and put all the troops up north, right? That's not, right. That would be absurd, right? That would be totally irresponsible, right? Everyone understands there has to be limits. The question just is how right? How strong is your resistance to, right? You know, is your, are you, right? Do you, it would be, now part of the claim is always be bitter as a matter of policy for everyone else to be convinced that you won't pay, you won't overpay. Right? It's always, you know, it's always better if you can say we don't negotiate with terrorists or we're making an exception for you. Right? That's always better than us presumption we negotiate. Now the only question is, we're talking about how much we're negotiating, right? You know, about what we're the prices.
Doesn't it seem to you like it's not the law that dictates or that influences your bias? It's more the other way. It's the current situation that influences your bias. You tend to ignore the law if the current situation touches your heartstrings, let's say.
So that's, you know, I think that part of the purpose of law is to protect your heartstrings.
Protect your heartstrings and protect society from your heartstrings.
Yeah, right, that's part of it, right? Because that's true in, you know, in every area of halacha, right? There are always going to be stories that touch your heartstrings, and they should. And at the same point, right, you know, if a society, you know, the idea of having law is that to some extent you can't react sentimentally to situations. Some people react more than others, and some people think laws are irrelevant not because of heartstrings but because of politics. I think it's just a political decision, and there's no point. Right? We'll see Poskim, right, who look at Rav Avadia and say, "What are you talking about?" So I think, like, here is again the important to understand that Rav Avadia was asked this question by the families of the Entebbe captives at a point when government policy was we don't negotiate with terrorists. And what he'll end up doing is releasing a statement to the government, which essentially promises orthodox support for a government decision to negotiate. Right, that's what the law does. Right, the law does is the law is a proxy for, right, for you don't have to worry about being criticized by the orthodox community for this because we'll cover you. Right, so law plays a political role.
Right, I'm just not sure the families of the hostages right now would care.
Yeah, I don't know. But the family hostages then, did they care, or did they just want to, you know, did they care about what Rav Avadia said, or did they just want Rav Avadia's, right, lined up politically? The answer is probably, but somebody cared about what Rav Avadia would say.
Right.
Yeah. Then. And do they care now? I don't know. You know, I think...
I doubt it.
I think it's an interesting question. You know, they're... I think it's an interesting question about how much the traditional and the Dati Lumi communities and the Haredi communities are influenced by the positions that are framed as halacha. There's always two questions: how much are the communities influenced by positions that are framed as halacha, and how much are the positions that are framed as halacha really law?
Today I was reading this was an interesting poll in Israel among the Jewish community about which of the two stated goals of Israeli goals of this war should take
precedence. Yeah.
And it split based on community, at least that's how it was reported, with I'll just broadly say the sort of Likud right wing community placing more emphasis on the destroying Hamas and the
secular.
Not, you know, placing more emphasis on bringing the hostages. Now, it's a poll, yada, yada, yada. But
it could be.
And, you know, they didn't give people the chance of saying, we want both, right? You had to pick one.
Right. And what are the consequences that you believe will follow from, right? Those are, I think.
But just to the point, I think people, I can imagine people are all over the map. I mean, I know when I look internally at myself, I change every 2 or 3 microseconds, right? It's impossible.
It's not a halachic state, and right, and you know, and there are some religious parties, but the influence, you know, they're always having that. My sense is, like, you know, I have students, I have a certain amount of public voice, and it can move the meter a little bit, you know, because it's a rhetorical thing, right? Let's say, you know, some X person gets up and writes op-ed saying the Torah says pinyon shvuyim is the most important value, and right, and that, you know, that gives people cover and makes them feel safe and good. I'm expressing Jewish values, and then somebody else, you know, so somebody writes a piece saying, no, actually, that has no relevance to the current situation. That moves the needle back, and then somebody else says, and this isn't really just pinyon shvuyim, this is really because nevish, and right, Halacha is a way. David Hartman had a beautiful line that influenced me a lot. He said, halacha, at its best, is the shared spiritual language of the Jewish people. Right? That it's a way in which we're supposed to be able to have these conversations. And not the outcome is not necessarily psak. Right? It's just a way in which we have the conversation about what should happen. And it's a way of having a conversation that gives right, that gives weight to values. Right? My friend Elisha Solovich is, you know, I think like his art is like the goal of halachic conversation is to make sure that all the values are right are expressed. And then you weight them. Right? There's all sorts of metaphors for that. Both of those, I think, are really good things about the purpose of halacha. There are lots of things that are halacha about which people shouldn't necessarily ask shilas. And that doesn't mean that halacha is irrelevant. It just means that the goal of halacha is to enable people to make their decision as opposed to have someone else make the decision for them. Generally, my belief is that's what halacha is supposed to do. It's supposed to help people make decisions, and all poskim are supposed to do is help clarify.
We're taught to always consult, see why.
See your local Orthodox rabbi. But when you see your local Orthodox rabbi, it doesn't mean that he's supposed to tell you what to do. Or, right, we'll gender it for now. Right? It might mean that the goal. Last year, right, I think I gave his comment. Your site was last week again, right? That Moshe Kahn's. His only real published article was about the notion that people shouldn't ask shilas about birth control. Women specifically shouldn't ask shilas about birth control. Right? They should be, that the teacher should teach them what the values and halachic framework is, and then that's the kind of thing you have to make your own decision about because you know more about. And to people's frustration, I often respond to shilas by creating context, and it's like, how much of this do I have to tell you, and how much of this, where's the point at which I know less than you. And I think the case where I have to, the communities, someone has to make a decision in communities. There has to be a decision procedure. And sometimes individuals properly recognize that they cannot make the decision themselves because like they're too emotionally involved, because they're just stuck, right? I'm the kind of person, I get stuck in personal life. Right? So I need someone else to make decisions for me because I hit a point of absolute equilibrium. Asimov's robot stories. I relate very much to Asimov's robot stories where you go insane because the potentials are exactly equal and you can't make a decision. That just happens to me too often. Not so much for other people, but for myself. Right? It's like ironic, like you went into being a mosaic, right? But
you should never put two identical apples in front of you.
Yeah, right? that's really a hard. I think. I don't think the purpose of this is to decide what the government should do and we'll end up with a sock, but I think it's to have a much deeper conversation about what the values are and to what extent like we're supposed to, we're not true to ourselves if we don't, right? There's an argument that, in this case, the really fascinating thing is that, right, is the claim that this is a case where heartstrings won over what would have been the halacha. This is like historically, there's what the halacha clearly should have been, and then what people did, and at some point, there's a claim that at some point the poskim just acknowledged, wow, this isn't working, and went along, right? So I have to see if we think that's a compelling read of Jewish history, and that's an interesting notion. But then, of course, somebody can claim, well, that's something you can afford in Galus, right? That's the whole. Obviously, the historical situation of the Jewish people as a whole is gonna trade, and we'll see. Like, there's a story that takes place in the immediate aftermath of the Churban, and we're gonna argue, no, that's unique. The immediate aftermath of the Churban is a different historical situation, right? Then people argue post-date is a different situation. So all that'll have to come up. And at the end, I found reading the Tshuva to be a fascinating experience for myself, watching how I went flip back and forth, and now I'm reading lots of other people and seeing how that plays out. But again, I start off with enormous respect for Rav Avadia and the way in which he conducts ethical conversations in halacha. But on the other hand, I loved him as a posik and not as a politician. But I think this is... It's sort of like strikes me as he's aware of the politics, but isn't that right? But there's no political interest in what's going on. But it's an interesting analysis. Like, you know, there are lots of parts of this trip that I don't know I would have thought were necessary. Okay, let's do, pray if you make some progress. This, because only, we're only, you know, this is only the first 16 pages. Rest assured, even my file is already 23 and it's nowhere near, and you know, it's going to be much longer. Okay, so we did, right, so the Nuki Yosef, I just wanted to point out to you, right, but that's the second to last source on page 6, says the following. So the rabbi said that if a wife was captured and they asked 10 times right, 10 times her value, so he says, right, so Rav Shimon Gamliel says you shouldn't redeem her. Why? Bipnei tikkun olam, imishum duchakasiburas, because of public economic pressure, imishum shli ragudul shavayin lalos bidmein, or so as not to encourage captors to raise prices. The Kaimelan Kershim and Gamliel Shain Kofin Labal Lifdos Yotribidameh. We pass on Kershim and Gamliel that we don't force the husband to redeem her at more than her value, but we allow him to. And we don't force him to. That's right. So that's in terms of husbands, it's only right. It's only right. The line means only that we don't obligate him, not that we don't permit him. And then maybe that's true regularly. Generally, that's not. But here's the line: the Chayshinan Ledocha Kadidei Kimo de Chayshinan Ledocha Tzibura. Because we worried about husbands going to poverty also. So if we create an obligation for husbands to redeem wives at any value, so then every husband whose wife is captured goes bankrupt. So we can't obligate husbands to pay any price, because that just right, that is an unfair burden to place on any individual to say that they have to redeem at any price. Right? That's an interesting claim. Right, so he doesn't think that, even though we saw like other people think that the whole rationale is just because we're afraid of what will happen next time. No, even one time, right? He understands that there, right, that even one time things are unreasonable to impose the obligations. If we do a whole, you know, Shas-wide exploration, we'll have to figure out, is that really true? Because there are all sorts of people who, like, a perfectly reasonable argument to make is that a person is obligated to spend enormous amounts of money to avoid violating any prohibition. And according to the Rambam, by not redeeming captives, you violate all sorts of prohibitions. Like closing your hand, right? Standing idly by your brother's blood. So why should there be a concern about somebody's having to spend too much if we have a general, right? So we can say, oh, that's why the rabbis had to make legislation, because really you should, of course, be obligated to spend all your, right? To spend all your money on this, right? This is a, right? So really, this is a law which we understand goes against the spirit of the law.
Why is there's, I guess it's an assumption that it's the spouse who's responsible for coming up with the money, rather than the community, say?
So if the community, I think if the spouse is the first resort.
Why?
So because we put it in the ketubah. I think that's the question. Why do we put in the ketubah as opposed to just leaving it as a communal obligation?
So is taking someone captive considered a personal event, or
right? In other words,
or if a community event, or
if the Jews go to war, and it's considered the whole community, the people, then why wouldn't it be the burden of the community to redeem any of the captives rather than the burden on the husband? Right. If someone is just kidnapped randomly, that would be a different story. Mm-hmm. So I get your question.
Right. I mean, it comes out in trivial ways. I think, you know, like in Israel today, do these kids go off to Tzahal and they don't have enough equipment for whatever combination of reasons, and the families are.
Yes, I think we have moved, you know, for warriors, like we have moved away from the medieval model where, you know, where the squire is obligated to, right, to outfit him, right, to outfit, because the squire was the government in those cases, you have to admit. I think you're right that, you know, that prisoners of war are very different than, right, we're not, the captives we're talking about here are not soldiers, right, and there's no discussion I'm aware of in rabbinic literature about, right, prior to the 20th century about redeeming soldiers, because you had no Jewish soldiers fighting for the Jewish community.
But were they taken captive because they were Daniel, who lived at 54 Brook Road and had some equity in the house, or are they taken captive because Daniel's Jewish?
So I think there are a whole bunch of
variables. Or something else.
One is, are you Jewish? Right. The other is, are you being taken captive by a private individual?
Mm-hmm.
Are you taken captive by a quasi, right, by privateers? Mm-hmm. Or are you being taken captive by a government? Right. That's right. Those are all variables, and the Gemara doesn't give you enough guidance.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So we'll have to play that out through history, because mm-hmm. the government doesn't give you because the Gemara assumes you know its context, but we don't.
Right. I mean, they could have said, we won't make an obligation to that you have to go into poverty to redeem your spouse. But if that's the situation, then the community should raise money.
But maybe, or maybe, right?
But they don't, I guess they don't say that.
Community has, right? Maybe don't. But again, I think it's possible to argue that they understand, like, everything in halacha should drive you to that. And then just say, look, this is a cold public policy decision, which we understand is always going to be, right? All we're trying to do is understand there's always going to be so much enormous pressure, right, to free hostages, that we're going to try and range the law as strongly as we can against overpaying. Because otherwise, otherwise you're always going to overpay, because narrow pressure groups with strong emotional, right, positions are going to win. So you set the law up against it, and you understand there's always going to be an argument to suspend the law and things like that. But we don't really want a situation where people are constantly right with the community can never plan around anything else, because as soon as you collect any kind of savings, right, that creates the incentive for somebody to capture a member of your community.
I think that point. I've read that that's come up in policy discussions within Israel of folks who will say, okay, during a time of quiet, we should make these stringent rules about what a government can and cannot do in a hostage situation. Because at this point, when things are quiet and we're not all emotionally involved, we can make those decisions that will protect us. I'm using the word broadly. Right. When God forbid.
I think that's right. Many areas of law. And the purpose of law is to create defaults, you know, again, right, to protect you against yourself. Because you know you're not going to be able to feel it, right? You know you're not going to be able to resist, right? So you set up rules that bind yourself to, and maybe they don't work.
Right. I mean, when policies like that, which are really just policies, people change them on a dime when the situation changes.
But there are defaults, right? It takes a lot of, depends on your governmental system, right? The United States, like, we had a system for a long time that people argued it was a success, because the goal was to prevent Congress from doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
Now there's a problem. We actually want Congress to do certain things, but the goal was to create a system which was so complicated, right? That you can't make decisions on a whim, on a whim in Congress, right? That was the theory, right? The Congress was set up to shield against populist excess, and during the Iraq War and Afghanistan, even though I'm a hawk politically, but when people made the argument, democracies don't do evil, so I think I was like, I was reading Thucydides, and the direct democracy of Athens votes to massacre the colony, its former colony of Melos, in anger, and then they think better of it a day later, and they send their ship after the original ship, but it's too late, the massacre already took place. So democracies can do really horrible things, because you want delays built in, you want defaults built in, and I think that's the question is how strong a default, and how strong a default do we want built in against either compelling people to pay any price, or even allowing people to pay any price, because we know that that's gonna be enormous pressure. How do you say no? And how do you say no? Even if you know that the consequences are that it's going to be another case tomorrow. And even if you know the consequences are going to be that your entire social safety net is destroyed, right? Mm-hmm. Just okay. That was Zemuke Yosef said, right, that we care about individual concerns. And then the Ra'ah just has a technical point where everyone says, like, the Gemara in Gittin asks what the rationale is. We should have been able to say that since the Tanakhama says that husbands are allowed to, the Tanakhama Ketubah says that the husbands are allowed to redeem, so it must be that anyone who allows anybody to redeem above value thinks that the issue is communal poverty and not concern for what will happen next, because concern will happen next will apply even to individuals. So the question everyone asks is, so why don't we resolve, right? The Gemara and Gittin has this abstract conversation. Is it because of concern that it'll happen again or because of communal poverty? And it tries to resolve it from the case of a daughter and says, well, maybe that guy acted against the rabbi's wishes. Why don't they just say it's a machloket? The Tanakhama, who says that husbands are allowed to redeem, must say that the issue is about happening again. And Rosh Hashanah says you can't. Must say the issue is, right, must say, right, sorry, the other way. Tanakhama, who says husbands are allowed to redeem, must say that the issue is only about communal poverty. And Rosh Hashanah, who says he's not allowed to redeem, must say the issue is going to happen again. So most people find all sorts of ways of distinguishing, but the Rosh says something quite, I think, quite amusing. Last line of page 6. He says, Efshalomar, you know, we could have explained it that way. They could have answered the question by saying it's a machloket, and this machloket is between the Tanakh, right, the Tanakhama and Shimon Gamliel. But Elad Ashkechan Kavasi Tuva Talmud Milsidi Boylan Bechad Duchta. But we find the Gemara often that asks a question in one place, Umisha Beduchta Achrita Meila, and another place it's obvious what the answer is. Below my sin in La La, but the Gemara doesn't cross reference. So we okay, right. So yeah, right. So as opposed to everybody else who has to engage in all sorts of gyrations to try and figure out like how you can make it, oh, says, no, don't worry about it. Okay. I thought that was fun. Okay, so now we're gonna move on to Rav Avadia himself. This is section 16. He begins he has the first part is about whether you can risk some lives to save others. Now he gets to our issue, which is redeeming captives at above their value. Right. Obviously, the implicit question is whether whether risk to life is a value as such, so that risking someone's life to save a hostage is always overpaying. We're going to bracket that for now. So he's right, and we're going to largely trust Rav Avadia's citations. Just be aware that his citations are often not word for word. He often adds in things to clarify without telling you. But usually it doesn't make a difference. So I just set it up with to begin with, where when he quotes, I change the font to Times Roman. Right, so we're reading Rav Avadia. This is all right. The first paragraph is section 16 of Rav Avadia's Tshuva with the citations inside instead of doing all the citations externally. Okay, so he said, "L'chora dain yeshli don didam." We can still ask our question, which is about whether we can negotiate to free the Entebbe captives. Mimasha shini begitin. So the Gemara there says, hey, we don't redeem captives more than their value. We saw that already. And the Gemara asks the question, you said it's because of Tikkun Olam. Is that because of Doche Kitzibura, because it's going to impoverish the community, or because we're afraid that they'll come attack us more? And Rashi says, right, Rashi says that the rationale, but the difference, nafkamina, between the two reasons is a private relative, right? Because if you're worried about future events, then private relatives can't redeem either. But if you're worried about communal poverty, then we should allow private figures to redeem. And the Gemara brings the case of Levi Bar Darga, who redeems his daughter at what seems to be an excessive price, and Abaye says maybe he acted against the will of the sages. Okay, so now we get to, here's the Rambam. The Rambam says, Vezeh Lashon HaRambam, right? That's the next Ariel thing. The Rambam says, Ein Podinus Ashruim B'Yisrael K'dei Deman Ipnei Tikkun Olam Shelo Yehu Oivim Rudfim Achareim L'Shavotam. Rambam, right, makes a decision one way, and he says the reason is not because of economics. The reason is because we're afraid that more Jews will be captured. All right, if you negotiate with terrorists, then you encourage terrorists. Okay, the Chassid Marana Kesef Mishnah, right? The Kesef Mishnah writes about that the Rambam paskins like the second reason, and that is also the Psak of the Rav Shekhan Pasak Karif. That's also what Rav Yitzchak Alfasi rules, so we know that's going to be the way in which the Mechaber rules, because Kesef Mishnah is the same figure as the author of Shulchan Aruch, right? It's Rav Yosef Kara, and he tells you the Rambam and the Rif paskin this way, and his rule is the Rambam and the Rif are two of his three figures, and once the Rambam and the Rif paskin the same way, he's going to rule against the Rush. And we saw that maybe the Ramah will bring the Rush in. But here's what he says now. He says, V'chein pasko tur Shulchan Aruch, right? That's right. L'fize makom yesh berosh lamar. Therefore, Avadia says, we can say at the very beginning, that freeing a large number of terrorists, as is being requested in our case, on the basis of this, right, of the actions of their friends, the hostage takers, it will encourage them to risk themselves more. And they'll make an effort to capture another plane. Sheesh Barbe Yudim, which contains lots of Jews, in order to extort the release of other friends who are terrorists who are currently imprisoned in Israel. The Shayach Nami Bechia Gavna, Atalma the Dilma Ligrafu Velaisvitve. So the rationale, we're afraid that they'll capture more, is not an economic rationale, it's a policy rationale. And that policy rationale should apply whether we pay in people, whether we pay in money or people. So therefore, therefore, they're going to cause more damage to the Jews. So Ravadia's first argument is maybe, since the Rambam and the Rif paskin that it's not an economic concern but a policy concern, and that we're worried about the risks of we weigh the risk of freeing the people in front of us against the risk that more people will be captured. And the answer is that if we overpay, more people will be captured, and we don't take that risk. So then, whatever we give the captives, that is considered more than the market price, and lots of terrorists sounds like more than the market price. So we shouldn't do it, right? That's his opening argument. Now he's going to have to try and cite sources that give him a way out of that argument, right? Because that's a good prima facie, right? He's honest. That's a good prima facie argument, right? If the concern is impoverishing the community, okay, so we're not. This has nothing to do with money. But if the concern is policy, this is bad policy. And the Rambam and the Rif both paskin is bad policy. Okay, so he's going to quote two stories. We're going to do the two stories inside, and then next week we'll talk about, we'll see how he uses the story. The first story is another Gemara in Gittin, Daf Nun Chelam Aleph. Tanu Rabbanan, we learned in a Braita. Ma'aseh Rabbi Yeshua ben Chananya, Shalach Lekrach Gadol Shebaromi. Rabbi Yeshua ben Chananya, who is living presumably immediately after the Korban. That's when he becomes prominent, is in the aftermath of the destruction. And he travels to Rome, which is the author of the destruction. Amrlo, and they say, tell him while he's in Rome, Tinok echad yesh beveita asurim, there is a child in prison, a Jewish child in Roman prison. Yefei naim v'tov ro'ik v'sasavzirim lo taltalim. And he's very attractive. Why that matter is not clear at all. But it means he has charm. Everyone understands. When we say tinok, it doesn't mean an infant. It means there's a kid who's being held in a Roman prison. Halach v'amad al petach beit asurim. He goes and stands at the entrance of the prison. Amar mina talim shisei Yaakov Yisrael abilzazim. He says, who has given Israel Yaakov's destruction in Israel to looters, which is the beginning of a quote of a pasuk. And now to Tinok v'Amer, Hashem zu chatanu lov lovu b'drachav, lov lovu b'drachav halok v'lo shem'u b'torato. Right, it's God who's done this to us because we didn't listen to God. Okay, so this kid has the bekiyas in Tanakh. He's quote a pasuk again, the kid can quote a pasuk back, and the kid's pasuk is also a vidui. Right. Why am I in captivity? Is not cursing. Right, he's not complaining. He's not saying this is unfair. He's saying, no, I am, right, I represent the Jewish people. The Jewish people deserve this, and I am just suffering the fate of the Jewish people. Amar, Sir Rishon Chanani is very impressed. He says, Muftechani bo shemura rabbi Yisrael. I know that this guy is going to grow up to be a great Torah scholar who's going to teach halacha. Avoda, right, so I swear. She'eni zaz mikan ad sheftenu b'chol mamon sheposkin alav. I won't move from here until I redeem him, whatever the price. Amru, and so the report is, Lo zaz misham, ajib do mimalon harbe. He didn't move from there until he redeemed him at a great cost. Lo it wasn't very long, Acho Hora Rabbi Israel. In fact, he became a great rabbi. And who does he become? He becomes Rishmael ben Elisha, who is the Kohen Gadol. Okay, I put that not in bold because I don't know if that's part of the original Tadidic story or later. It seems to me that this is a common thing, like after you have an Arab and it says, Umanu, who is he? And that's usually Amoraic and not Tadidic. But I think this is probably a later addition. There are other stories where Ishmael ben Elisha's kids being held captive. That's the terrible story we didn't write in Yom Kippur, right? They find out the brother and sister after their captors try and... Okay, now this is a story which clearly takes place immediately after the destruction of Rome, when Rome has absolute power. And this is not somebody who's being held by private figures. It's being held by the Roman government. But the Roman government will release people for money. But why is Rav Shimon bar Hananya, like, what justifies him? If we possibly Rav Shimon Gamliel, you're not supposed to overpay, and he pays an enormous amount for a kid. Now, we could always give an answer, which nobody does so far as I know, that attractive children are worth an enormous amount on the slave market. If you put them up for auction, that's what he would have had to pay. You could always make that claim. So far as I know, no one does. It has the virtue of being the only good explanation for why we care about the kids' attractiveness. Right, that's right. That the kid is in danger, right, of being sold, you know, as a sexual slave, and that will be very expensive, right? And so what he's doing is not. He doesn't go because he is attracted by the description. He goes because he understands that this kid is going to be really expensive to redeem, and he wants to know if the kid is worth it. And the answer is the kid is worth it. Okay, but so far as I know, nobody halachic has ever made that argument. Although, you know, at some point, I should find somebody. The kind of thing maybe Rav Henkin will have made, right? To that way. Okay, that's story number one. But here we have a story plainly in which somebody is redeemed for more than their right for more than which most people understand this as being they're redeemed for more than their market value. And the question is why? Why if the story is okay, and it seems like Rav Shimon bar Hananya is valorized for this. Right? Why is that okay?
I want to know how he raises money just by standing there.
Well, it can't just mean Rome, right? I won't leave Rome. And there is a right. There is a wealthy Roman Jewish community, right? It's one of the things all the way through, right? That the Jews rebel, but the Jews have support from Jews and from Judaophiles. Mm-hmm. All through the Roman Empire. That's if you want to raise money, going to Rome is a fine place to raise money for Jews. You have to bring lots of money to Rome to bribe the Romans, but that's part of the Romans don't want to really be bribed by Jews of Rome so much, right? Because that they already have internal reasons, right? So if you come to bribe them, you have to have some. Okay, that's story number one. Okay, now we got story number two. This is Gemara and Gittin.
Can I ask another question?
Yeah,
I'm sorry. Is the assumption, are we assuming here that whoever is doing the capturing, the Romans, their motive is financial? Now, obviously, that's not true within Tebi, right?
Yeah.
But is that, well, are we assuming that?
Motive is an interesting, like, we assume that that money is enough to free the captives.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Is enough.
In Rome, right? That given enough money, they'll free every captive. But it might be that they'll set the price at such a point where they're sure they'll have lots of slaves. They're not willing to free all the Jewish slaves, mm-hmm. But they'll willing for you know. But they'll you know they have 1,000 Jews in prison. They want 1,000 Jews in prison. They don't care which 1,000 Jews, right? Or not, they don't really care 999 or 1,000, right? Mm-hmm. So you can buy people off at the margins, right? That's a historical reality question. We don't know. Mm-hmm. That would be my bet. Is the way most people understand it is that they wish to show the political subjugation of the Jews, or they think that there's a critical mass of Jews, right? They need to hold a certain number, right? And uncomfortably, right? Understand this is to some extent the parallel to the current Israeli position regarding Palestinians. That you need the number of free terrorists to be below a certain critical mass, because you can watch X number, mm-hmm. right? But which ones particularly, right? You know, it's not right. Right, you can't catch everybody who throws stones, but you want throwing stones to have casual, right, to have consequences. But you understand that freeing this person, right, keeping this person in prison because they threw a stone is not really going to change, right? No individual is going to change this mm-hmm. the situation. No 10 individuals are going to change the situation, right? So that's what the Romans think about Jews. Right, you know that we want a certain number of their important prisoners from important families, right? Because we want this pesky Judea stuff to go away mm-hmm. for once and for all. But you know they have private prisons, right? It's like Mississippi, right? And you can pay your way out of it, right? If you have enough money. But you understand, right? Rav Shimon Levi is making a choice. Mm-hmm. Now it might be, however, right, that he's right that. He doesn't, right? It might be, we could argue that his choice has no consequences in terms of the future. Because the motive wasn't financial. Right? That's where you got that question. The motive was to break the political backbone of the Jewish people. But then, okay, right, so if we can get a little bit of money out of it without risking the overall goal. And they're always private.
This time, the Romans have achieved their goal.
Right.
There's no Jewish state anymore.
That's right. And there isn't going to be another Jewish rebellion, we think, because we have enough of the Jewish leaders in prison. There isn't going to be another Jewish rebellion. Right? And then, people should reach more regularly. There's always one prisoner. you have to be worried that you have the... But people don't think that way because we don't know which one it is. Right? And they're always going to be individuals who are not... There are individuals who figure they're patriotic, but they're not that patriotic. Right. So often captives were spoils of war, and victorious generals got to keep captives, and it was assumed that they would keep a lot of them as part of their political position, so they could parade them at important things to show what great generals they are, and then they would also cost lots of money to be a Roman politician. Mm-hmm. And part of the way you got the money was by selling your captives. But it's not good for you if you sell all your captives, right? Then you look poor. But if you can sell a few captives for lots and lots of money, right, then you can give the bread and circuses, and you can have your slaves participate in the bread and circuses. Well, some of them will be killed probably. Right? That's also, figure out that's part of your investment. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's read the last Gemara. We'll finish with that, and then next time we'll pick up how everybody does it. Okay, so the Gemara Gittin says the following: Hamocheret atzvan v'banav lo'vdei kochavim, ein podinoto. Okay, so if somebody sells themselves into slavery, presumably for economic reasons, we don't redeem people who sell themselves into slavery to non-Jews, right? Because that is right there, taking money out of our community, and they should have more self-respect. Right, so you could always ask what caused them to sell themselves into slavery. The answer is people would rather sell themselves into slavery to non-Jews than Jews, because they sell themselves into slavery for non-Jews. Well, we create a perverse incentive. If we redeem them, then they know. Right, that's a way to encourage, right, to force the Jewish community to support them economically. So we don't do it. But after the father dies, then we redeem the children. Because the children really didn't make the decision, right? Minor children, that's how the father can sell them. So minor children, right, we're not, right, we don't have to worry about perverse incentives. Okay. Then Rav Asi comes along and says, V'husha machar v'shana v'shileish. We redeem him the first time. And we redeem him the second time. But the third time, come on. Right? That's right. This point, obviously, right, we're just enablers. And we're not actually, right, we're not actually helping people out of poverty. Okay, so now we have a story. How did they mixi the yaspi zuzir of the kochavim? So these people borrowed money from non-Jews. And they couldn't pay it back. So asuvik garbilu. So they went and kidnapped them. Asulakamed Rafuna. So they came before Rafuna, and they say, "Please rescue us!" Right? Presumably they're released from whatever prison they're being held in long enough to go to Beit Din. Right? Or it could be their family comes and says, "Right, whatever it may be." So the case gets to Rafuna, and he says to them, "My yavin luchu, right? We have Mishnah which says that we don't redeem you, and Rabbi Abba, who's standing there, says, "But you taught us only two or three times." So his response is, "Hani margil regili davde achir." These are habitual, right? So they did it before, or right, they're gambling addicts, whatever it may be, right? So this plays out the story lemaase, right? That we don't redeem people, and maybe two or three times is not actually an objective measure. It's we don't redeem people who are in a situation which is likely to repeat, right? Who are in a cycle. Okay. How gavra d'zavi nafshi l'ludoi? So there's a guy who sells himself to the Ludoim. That Ludoim seem to be cannibals, whoever the Ludoim are.
they're not residents of Lod.
No. There's some kind of ethnic people who enjoy killing people. Right? That's I don't know anything about historically, right? But in the Talmud, they're pretty wild. They're bad people. Also, the coming Rabbi Ami, I'm really Pirkan, and he comes to Rabbi Ami and says, "Hey, I sold myself to Ludaim. You got to save me." I'm really. So he quotes the same Mishnah. But he quotes it in a different way. He says, somebody who sells themselves, their children of the Kochavim, we don't redeem him, but we redeem the sons after, right? Afterwards, but he has a line which was not in in our Mishnah, which says, Mishum Kilkula, because we're afraid that they will, if we leave the children in non-Jewish hands, they're going to apostatize. So if we redeem people over their market, right? If we redeem people because we're afraid they're going to apostatize, now he has a great line. He says, V'chol shekein hacha, di'ika k'tala. So, right? So therefore, Rabbi Ami says, we have to redeem here. If we have to redeem people in order to avoid their apostasy, we certainly have to redeem them to avoid them being killed. Now, this is a wild claim because we thought the reason Pidyon Shvuyim was so important is because there's a risk of being killed. So why is Rabbi Ami saying this is a special case because he's being killed? Always going to be killed.
Well, not the case we were just talking about beforehand.
Yeah, so it turns out that when we said that Pidyon Shvuyim is the most important thing in the world always, because Pidyon Shvuyim was Gemara, we saw, right, that Pidyon Shvuyim contains everything, is everything else including death. Well, not all Pidyon Shvuyim really involves death in quite that way. When it comes to like real death, real like certain death, like Ludaim, all of a sudden Rabbi Ami says, now that, and here, right, here we don't do it. He doesn't say anything about two or three times, right? Just, but maybe the first time he did it, right? Just, no, we're going to redeem him because he's going to die. So then there's a whole conversation in which the rabbis say, but he's like, he's just a bad guy. he's not from at all. He eats treif. He eats treif deliberately. He eats treif even if he has an option of kosher food. And even if he has, you know, maybe even if he has an option of kosher food that costs the same amount. So we have no communal obligations to him at all. Okay, that's not relevant to our conversation, right? You know that generally nowadays we don't apply that category at all. So we're left with a story in which Rabbi Ami is represented as somebody who deliberately sells themselves into a situation where their life is at risk and then comes and demands being redeemed. And Rabbi Ami says, yeah. Even if a Jew deliberately puts themselves at risk, we have an obligation to pay to redeem them. Okay, and that's different than the usual obligation to redeem captives. Okay, so now we have two stories which are different than the usual case. One case in which we explicitly paid more than the market price, and one case which we just said this is not the usual. These are not the usual rules, right? And Rav Avadia is going to try to put those two stories together to create an argument that says that the Entebbe case is not a case where it's forbidden to overpay. Okay, I'll pick it up next week.
Thank you.
Thank you.